The drought out west could be a business opportunity for the water-rich east. There's just one problem.
If you have a large quantity of water, that's great. If your water is polluted, it's useless.
I'm Carol Holsoppel. This week on the Allegheny Front, how dirty water could put a damper on economic revitalization. And some say a recent decision by the Public Utility Commission makes the future of solar a little less sunny.
It's just a way to try to knock solar off the roofs of Pennsylvanians.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Testimony continues in a water contamination case that dates back to the early days of Pennsylvania's shale gas boom. Cabot Oil and Gas is in federal court in Scranton defending itself against two Dimmock, Pennsylvania families who say the company polluted their water. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips has more.
The lead plaintiff in the case against Cabot Oil and Gas is one of their own former employees, Nolan Scott Ely. Ely testified that when he worked operating bulldozers for the company back in 2008 and 2009, there was competition among work crews to drill the fastest hole. Ely says he witnessed fuel and acid spill onto the ground, and he says he punctured the lining of a waste pit with a backhoe. The Dimmock resident is suing Cabot Oil and Gas for polluting his nearby water well. State environmental regulators determined Cabot was responsible for water contamination in the town. But the company continues to say it's not at fault. An attorney for Cabot told the jury the science is on its side. Cabot remains barred from drilling in a 9-square-mile area of Susquehanna County. The trial is expected to last several weeks. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Cabot Oil and Gas was also implicated in a huge fish kill in Dimmock as a result of spilling fracking fluid into a nearby stream. That was in 2009. Another industry could be causing unintended consequences for fish, this time in the Great Lakes. Lindsay Scullin reports an industrial chemical is showing up in trout. It's called perfluoro-1-butane sulfonamide, or FBSA.
Researchers traced this chemical back to several products. Those include detergents and stain-proofing products first used in 2003. Robert Letcher is a senior research scientist for Environment and Climate Change Canada. That's a department in the Canadian government. Almost all of the fish his team tested had detectable levels of this FBSA chemical in their bodies. We're talking low levels here, parts per billion low. Letcher says it was a surprise to find the chemical in fish.
We were the first to ever find this compound in the environment, like to demonstrate its presence. It's never been reported before.
The researchers don't know if other chemicals are breaking down into FBSA in the environment or if the chemical is coming straight from industrial products. Letcher says companies started using FBSA to replace a different chemical. Studies showed that previous chemical was breaking down and part of it was building up in the food web. In 2006, the Environmental Protection Agency put together an industry-wide agreement to phase that chemical out. So industries replaced it with chemicals like FBSA. And that's the chemical Letcher and his team are now finding in fish. He says scientists often have to play catch-up to figure out if there are problems with new chemicals brought onto the market.
When a body of evidence, scientific evidence, builds up great enough to basically render a negative decision against a compound and it gets regulated or what have you, companies phase these compounds out and they look for alternatives in which to use that are safer, but also to serve their purpose.
He says research into FBSA is so new, they just don't know much about what this might mean for fish or people who eat the fish.
It's completely impossible to tell because nobody's done anything with regard to toxicology. That's usually the way things go. You know, somebody like us, we find a new chemical and in this case in fish, and obviously a lot of aquatic fish toxicologists out there are going, well, you know, we should really try to understand what this chemical is doing to the fish, or not is doing, but could be doing to the fish.
Letcher says one of the next steps is to look at other species in the food web. That way, his team can figure out if the chemical is building up in other creatures. The study was published in the journal Environmental Science and Technology. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Lindsay Scullin.
Despite these kinds of clean water problems, advocates say abundant water in the Rust Belt could bring agriculture, manufacturers, and other businesses to the region, if the conditions are right. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports.
Last fall, I visited Youngstown, Ohio to check out Big Cricket Farms. They raise crickets in a small warehouse for restaurants and specialty foods. Owner Kevin Bachhuber and his partners moved from drought-stricken California to this old steel town because the rent was cheap and the water was plentiful.
Something that we've learned by being here is that it's important to, like, have both water quantity and quality.
In Youngstown, the farm would periodically have die-offs. They would lose entire generations of crickets. Bachhuber suspected the city water, so they started filtering it for the crickets' drinking water, but they were still using tap water for the humidifiers.
The babies, you know, spend most of their time in 90 to 100% humidity.
Without knowing it, Bachhuber says they were providing a highly chlorinated environment, and many crickets just couldn't make it.
I mean, it was horrifying to watch. Their back legs would stop working, and then they would start having, like, spasms.
Youngstown's chief water engineer says they do add chlorine at the end of the water treatment process. That's standard procedure, and that levels are consistently within federal drinking water standards. When I met with Bachhuber in February, it was at a coffee shop. So we're not meeting at the farm because the farm's already
closed. It's already closed, yeah.
Bachhuber says they lost 8 million crickets and 40 million eggs. That meant $100,000 in lost contracts because of the die-offs. This might sound like the unlucky tale of a small, quirky business, but big players like General Motors have also had water quality issues in aging industrial cities. Tom Wickham is spokesperson for GM in Flint, Michigan. Within months of the city of Flint's now infamous switch in 2014 from Detroit water to the Flint River for its water supply, Wickham says workers notice rust on the engine parts.
What we found was that in a machining operation in an engine plant, your chloride levels have to be lower than what the city was doing. Otherwise, you will have corrosion or rust on your machined parts.
GM switched its water supply back to Detroit a full year before the city of Flint switched back. Brian Stubbs is hearing an increasing number of stories about the need for clean water in manufacturing. He's director of the Cleveland Water Alliance, which brings together public water systems, universities, manufacturers, and other businesses.
The group has come together coalescing around what we call the value of water. The value of water being what does it mean in terms of economic value, clean water, and tying clean water to gross regional product.
Stubbs says, according to a study by his Cleveland Water Alliance, which is yet to be completed, water accounts for $6 billion of direct economic impact. That's 5 to 6% of the gross regional product of Northeast Ohio. Some cities like Milwaukee are creating hubs for water technology businesses. Pittsburgh also started looking into this about 5 years ago, but the work has stalled. Stubbs says water's time is coming as a major economic driver. It's key to where businesses now decide to locate.
15 years ago, water was within that, you know, relocation mix of a company, maybe like 13th or 14th on their priority level. It's now coming up to 3rd, 4th, or 5th. So now that has a larger impact on the decision on where they're going to locate.
Stubbs says nearly every business, from agriculture to beer brewing to industrial manufacturing, depends on water. And they want to know if cleaning it to meet their needs will cost 3 cents per gallon or 30 cents per gallon. And they don't want unexpected contaminants to cause temporary shutdowns. Stubbs sees the closing of Big Cricket Farms as a lost opportunity for a struggling city like Youngstown. Cricket farmer Kevin Bachhuber is still deciding where they're going to move next. He says it feels like he's on the front lines of some kind of water war.
It's so crazy. You know, I moved to California. They ran out of water. So I came here because there's a lot of water, and now the water's irreversibly tainted. It makes your next step be like, all right, what kind of water issue am I going to run into at my next, you know, place?
Big Cricket Farms is considering a move south to locate near other cricket farms that have had better luck with their water. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Thanks to Michigan Radio for some of the audio used in that story. We have some environmental news out of Beaver County this week. The Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection says recycled scrap metal contaminated with radioactive material was shipped from a facility in Beaver Falls to two processing facilities in Ohio. They say there's no risk to the public, but more on that story at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Pennsylvania has been mulling over how much money people can make by selling their extra solar energy to the grid.
This is something that the solar industry has been following very closely.
Is Pennsylvania's rooftop solar future so bright it has to wear shades? We'll find out later on the Allegheny Front. Stay tuned. Everybody knows the Sierra Club. It's a 124-year-old national institution. They protect wildlife, get people outdoors, and convince politicians and the public to move away from fossil fuels. But your grandfather's Sierra Club is changing. One thing they've done, hired its first director of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Nellis Kennedy Howard is a citizen of the Navajo Nation and has worked in Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. She says embracing diversity and inclusion isn't an add-on. It's now part of their everyday operations to meet what she calls the unprecedented environmental challenges we face today. I spoke with Kennedy Howard by phone about why she wanted to take this on.
I spent much of my life fighting for issues that I never should have fought for, never should have needed to fight for. Things like having my marriage recognized in the state that I live, in the country that I live. Things like fighting for the protection of tribal lands from exploitation, from corporate entities seeking to do damage to the environment. Fighting because of the economic situation of my background. Barriers that came up that no one should ever have to fight. You know, the oppression that comes with all those different things has always driven me to work on issues of equity and justice, whether it be through the energy sector working with Honor the Earth, the National Native Nonprofit Organization, or whether it's with Sierra Club. Ultimately, my work and my life's goal has been to make sure that principles of equity and justice are rooted wherever I am working. That is where I can make the biggest impact, where my story can be told, and where I can make change.
A couple of years ago, the Green 2.0 report, which was based on a survey of big environmental groups and foundations, revealed a serious lack of diversity, what they called a Green Insiders Club, by which they meant a white insiders club. And the report also said that many environmental groups say that they want diversity, but have really fallen short of that goal. So speaking from your experience, why is that?
That's such a good question. I'm glad you bring up the Green 2.0 report, which is a report that was done of over 300 different agencies, environmental organizations, and foundations. It also revealed in that report that there is oftentimes an unconscious bias or a discrimination and even uneven experiences for people of color in the environmental movement. And also that members of environmental organizations are predominantly white and that it's not uncommon for those organizations' memberships to be predominantly male. And Sierra Club can certainly relate to some of these statistics. We're a very large organization that spans across the continent and beyond with more than 2.4 million members and supporters. And people are bound to have varying experiences of unconscious bias or discrimination. And it is our goal to ensure that wherever a person might encounter Sierra Club, that that person, no matter who they are, what background they come from, whatever walk of life they're coming from, that they feel welcomed.
In addition to being a citizen of the Navajo Nation, you mentioned you're also a part of the LGBT community. How inclusive and accepting are environmental groups to gay and lesbian and trans people?
I was very excited to see Sierra Club kind of get involved in issues that aren't typically considered environmental issues. So, for instance, last year when same-sex marriage was recognized across the board, our executive director actually submitted a press release celebrating the occasion and talking about what a joyous event it is and how all people ought to be afforded the same rights in order to fully participate in different processes that are so important to human rights. So I'm honored to be part of an organization that was able to do that.
Because I'm also LGBT, and I don't know that I always feel like I want to reveal that when I go to outdoor events. So I'm just a little bit curious about just your experience with that, maybe not just the Sierra Club, but just in general.
I can empathize with you there, and I don't blame you. I have had my own unique experiences within the environmental community, Sierra Club included, that have not always been welcoming. That's part of the reason of why we're seeking to become that multicultural organization is because we are not yet. There are those uneven experiences that people are having. There's those toxic behaviors that do occur within Sierra Club and within other organizations. There have been experiences with people in the environmental movement who have laughed at me. So, for instance, if I mention that I am married to my wife, they will go out of their way to say it louder in a meeting. Or they will actually laugh in your face. And it's in those instances that a person such as myself or other leaders in the room can step up to that toxic behavior and to call them in, to use it as a tool to say this is inappropriate, to educate why that is a hurtful remark, why that is a harmful reaction for them to have, and in order to bring people in and in order to change the organizational culture. But we are seeking to rise above that. We're seeking to educate ourselves so that we are more inclusive, so that people, no matter who they are, feel that they can share who they are.
The press release about your new position quotes you saying, "I'm deeply committed to equality and justice and envision a path for the Sierra Club to become an anti-racist, anti-oppressive organization. And this change will not happen overnight and will require the efforts of everyone at the Sierra Club, including staff, volunteers, and members." So what will be some of your first steps to help create that change?
Some of the things that I see us taking on, and I should mention that for many within the organization, this is not new to us. We're already doing this work. We're already partnering with environmental justice communities. Oftentimes, the communities that are most impacted by environmental oppression are the same communities without a voice in the process or a seat at the table. We definitely, at Sierra Club, don't have all the answers for communities experiencing environmental oppression. So instead of swooping in to solve problems, we try to listen and we try to help these communities to tell their own stories whenever we can. And that's an approach that I hope we can model for other organizations that want to be more meaningfully engaged in environmental justice work. And ultimately, this is everyone's responsibility at Sierra Club. So we will be working to ensure that Sierra Club's goals are fully understood by all within the organization and that all staff and volunteers can clearly articulate how they are contributing to the organization becoming a welcoming, equitable, and inclusive organization.
Is this a change in direction for the Sierra Club? I don't know that a lot of people, when they think of the Sierra Club, might think anti-racist, anti-oppressive organization.
I think that's true. I don't think that people think of Sierra Club as an anti-racist, anti-oppressive organization. So it's exciting to be able to say this, that we are doing this. Like I said, for many within the organization, this is not new to us. But for others, this is new. They're still grappling with how can they be involved. Diversity is more than just staff demographics. Is equally about organizational culture, how we operate, how we communicate both internally and externally, how we organize and build relationships, how we run our meetings and the language that we choose to use.
What do you hope the Sierra Club will look like in 5 or 10 years?
You know, one of our goals is to better reflect the communities that we serve, and the American demographics are very telling, and they're moving, they're constantly changing. I know that we will need to adapt every step of the way, and the kind of push-pull tension that we feel as an organization of, are we doing this work quick enough? Are we making bold enough goals for ourselves versus others at the organization who are still struggling and grappling with what it means to become an inclusive organization? And I think that that is one of the challenges that we face, people across the organization and where they're coming from and the competencies that they have in this work and their ability to engage where they're at in order to move the work forward.
Nellis Kennedy Howard is the Sierra Club's first Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. There's more at our website about diversity in the environmental movement, including the Green 2.0 report that we mentioned. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
This is Reed Frazier, reporter for the Allegheny Front, and I have an important announcement to make. Over the last few weeks, you might have noticed something different about us. No, we haven't been working out. And no, this tattoo, we got that years ago. We have a new website. Same address, AlleghenyFront.org, but it looks a lot different. It's got lots of photos, videos, and special sections. Of course, it is a work in progress, and we'd love your feedback. You can find us in all the usual places, on Facebook, on Twitter, at Allegheny Front, or good old-fashioned email, info@AlleghenyFront.org. Hope to see you online.
Solar energy advocates say a recent decision by the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission will stifle alternative energy growth in the state. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports that the issue revolves around how much money residents can make selling their excess solar power back to the grid.
In Pennsylvania, anyone who puts solar panels on their rooftops can sell extra energy they don't use back to utilities. Up until now, the price they got for all of that extra energy equaled the price the rest of us pay for electricity. But the Public Utility Commission ruled that going forward, the amount of energy sold to the grid by rooftop solar producers at what is a more expensive retail price will be limited. Nils Hagen Fredriksen is the PUC spokesman. He says the limit is to keep from passing on more costs to the ratepayers.
The commission reached a compromise to promote more renewable energy, but at the same time to prevent the consumers of Pennsylvania from paying artificially inflated prices for power.
Utilities advocated for the change. But solar advocates say this will prevent new installations and make it harder to reap the upfront investment costs paid by homeowners. Kurt Limbaugh has solar panels on several of his properties. He says he doesn't buy the PUC's argument.
This isn't about an analysis of how it hurts other players. It's just a way to try to knock solar off the roofs of Pennsylvanians so the fossil fuel people can keep polluting and having money shoveled their way.
Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
The decision on net metering in Pennsylvania allows people with rooftop solar installations to sell energy back to the grid at the retail price. That's the price consumers pay. But it puts the limit on the amount of energy that can be sold back to utilities to 200% of the historical energy usage of a building, or 50 kilowatts of generation, whichever's lower. To find out more about what this means, I'm joined by Stephen Lacey, senior editor at Green Tech Media. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, how are you, Kara?
Good, thanks. The Public Utilities Commission is calling their recent decision in Pennsylvania a compromise because it still does allow rooftop solar owners to sell extra energy back to the utilities at a retail price and at a higher percentage than the utilities wanted, but it's still a limit. So what does that really mean?
Well, the limit really means that a homeowner can't just set up a large power plant in their backyard and get compensated at the retail rate. So it sets a limit at 200% of historical consumption. This is a very good compromise, actually. When you look at other states, Delaware has a 110% limit of historical consumption. New Jersey has a limit where you cannot exceed a customer's annual energy usage.
200% is more than the 110% that was proposed in Pennsylvania, and yet some solar advocates are not happy with this number. Isn't this good news for rooftop solar? Can you explain that reaction?
I think it is very good news for rooftop solar, honestly. There, of course, advocates are going to want more. They want as much access to the grid as possible. Well, the utilities claim that they have to pay for upkeeping that grid and that there should be limits on how much they compensate those solar generators and how much goes on the grid. Clearly, we need to find a compromise. Again, when you compare it to other states, particularly states like Nevada that have completely dismantled retail net metering. I think solar advocates should feel good that the Utility Commission didn't completely dismantle the law or go along with exactly what the utility wanted.
Is this a decision that people in the renewable sector around the country have been following, or was this a surprise?
This is something that the solar industry has been following very closely. There are skirmishes around net metering all around the country in dozens of states. So the solar industry is tracking how these battles play out state by state very closely. It's one of the hottest things in the solar industry today. Because retail net metering is, many solar advocates say, the bedrock of good solar policy. So when you change retail net metering and devalue solar, you fundamentally change the economics of the system, and you could potentially dismantle a market overnight. So people were following Pennsylvania. It's certainly not one of the hottest states right now. You know, states like California, Hawaii, Nevada, Arizona, where you have the most solar being installed and you have the most drastic changes potentially on the table. Those are the states that people are paying close attention to.
We talked with you a couple of years ago when these limits on net metering were proposed in Pennsylvania, and you've talked a little bit about what's happening in some of the other states. But what's the trend when it comes to net metering? Is it more favorable to the solar industry or towards the way that utilities are operating currently?
Overall, the trend is pretty good for the solar industry. You have a couple unique states like Arizona and Nevada, which have drastically cut net metering rates. A state like California recently upheld retail net metering. California represents more than 50% of solar installations in the U.S., so this is a pretty big deal. In general, when you look at a lot of the cases, the dozens of cases at regulatory commissions and legislatures across the country, they're looking at studying the benefits of solar and the costs of solar on the grid rather than making sweeping changes to retail net metering rates. So they're choosing to delay their decisions and choosing to explore the economic consequences rather than making rash decisions right away. And I think that's a hopeful sign for the solar industry in general.
The Clean Power Plan was put on pause by the Supreme Court recently, but it could push utilities towards more renewables, especially here in the East. Pennsylvania is going to go forward with its Clean Power Plan. How does the net metering debate play into the changes that could be brought about by the Clean Power Plan?
Well, the Clean Power Plan only accelerates the net metering debates because now states have to come up with a comprehensive plan to adopt technologies like solar. Once they do that over the next couple of years, you're going to see many more state markets open up that were once bit players. And when that happens, utilities are going to go to the commissions and say, wait a second, we need a different way to compensate solar. And you will see more of them ask to change retail net metering rates. But I think that the issue is already well underway. The battles are pretty strong in some leading solar states. It just accelerates those battles in states that may only have a small amount of solar today.
How much do these net metering limits really hurt the rooftop solar industry or people's decision to install solar?
It really depends upon the decision. So Nevada recently decided to slash retail net metering rates down to the wholesale rate over a 3-year period of time. And it also added more monthly fixed charges to people who are hosting solar on their rooftops. So this completely decimated the solar industry. The economics of solar just do not work right now in that state, and solar companies have pulled out. But in states like Maryland or New Jersey and now Pennsylvania, you've seen compromises that still maintain the retail rate for net metered solar electricity, but also set some sort of reasonable cap. I think what Pennsylvania did here was pretty fair, and within the boundaries of what many in the solar industry consider fair, when you look at the spectrum of decisions that we've seen across the United States related to this policy.
So it shouldn't inhibit the industry from growing here?
No, I don't think it will. The solar industry really is worried that regulators will make rash decisions, and that's why you get so many people who are excited about the issue and who are trying to put pressure on regulators. But when we look at the economics here, I don't think this is going to drastically impact the solar industry in Pennsylvania. I think you'll still see steady growth.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Stephen Lacey is the senior editor at Green Tech Media and co-host of their Energy Gang podcast. I'm Kara Holsapple. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. Join us again here next time or find us online at AlleghenyFront.org and on Twitter, we're at AlleghenyFront.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy. Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation.